the World. I'm John Batchelor. The 16th Amendment of the United States of America, 1913, reads in part, "The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states, and without regard to any census or enumeration." The question is, does the Congress have the power also to tax unrealized gains? There's a new case coming before the Supreme Court, Moore versus United States, 2023, turning on the complaint by a couple, Charles and Kathleen Moore, that they were being taxed on unrealized gains and that that was unconstitutional. Fortunately, I have Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing at Defining Ideas for the Hoover Institution, anticipating the Supreme Court's hearing of unrealized gains. I mention as an amateur, if this is likely empowered by the Supreme Court, it will completely upset the markets, which is a good thing, but it will be a new understanding of how you make money in the stock market. Richard, a very good evening to you. The Moore versus the United States seems to be high stakes, very high stakes. Is it, or am I overreading this? Good evening to you.
Well, you're not overreading it. There were two phases in this case. To begin with, just to give you a very brief summary, there's an exact sum in dollars and cents, which is in a corporation, which the Moores, as a minority shareholder, cannot exact from that corporation. What they've claimed is you can't tax me on money that I cannot possibly receive. But it's important to know that this is gain, which is perfectly realized, i.e. reduced to dollars and cents at the corporate level, but has not been distributed to the shareholder level. What the government does in order to, what Moore does in bringing the case, is he says the question presented asks whether you could do this consistent with the 16th Amendment, or is it perhaps a direct tax which has to be apportioned amongst the several states? And what that phrase means is not very clear to most people, but the simplest version of a direct tax is that what you're trying to do is to make sure that citizens in richer states pay a smaller fraction of their income than citizens in small and poorer states. And this was put into the original Constitution to make sure that you could not have a massive redistribution of wealth at the federal level, because people are afraid of that. And you're trying to make sure that every state regards itself as a winner when it comes in. Well, it turns out that he puts this thing forward, and then the government raises the ante. And it says, look, what are you talking about realization? We don't have a realization requirement at all in the Constitution. There's no reason why you have to be able to reduce this to dollars and cents in your own pocket. And they opened up the prospect that you could tax, not this particular case, but unrealized appreciation in every asset that anybody owns anywhere. And here's a very different problem. Now, the new problem is, well, you own stock, you have a lawsuit, and every year what you have to do is to figure out how much more income you have at the end of the year than you had at the beginning of the year and pay tax on that, whether or not you've converted it into cash or something like a marketable security. There was a famous economist in 1920 named Robert Haig, and what he said is after the Supreme Court had announced the realization requirement, there really was none. All you had to do is to calculate the distance between the two. Well, this put people into an absolute freak-out stage, because what it means is if you have artwork, if you have an ongoing lawsuit, you have 10,000 assets, and all you've done is to hold them, you now have to calculate the gain or loss in each and every one of them, figure out how to raise the money to pay it. And so there are estimation problems that never go away. And it turns out the liquidity problems, that is not having cash in hand to pay the debt. This will essentially, if you did the whole dance, would increase the total level of tax by tax 10,000 times over what it was. And there are tax amateurs like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders and Emanuel Saz and company, who actually think you could make this thing work because they've never dealt with any of this stuff in a real kind of life situation. And so what happens is you start getting people coming in on this, and the briefs that were written for the most part on my side of the case, which is that you can't do this, were trying to figure out what you meant by the word realization. And that's a hopelessly confused requirement with respect to unrealized stuff. It was never a topic of discussion, either at the time of the great case that prompted the 16th Amendment, Pollock against the Farmers Loan Company, or in the decision itself. And so I looked at this and I said, hey, there are two definitions of realization that you have to think about. One of them is this nightmare that you're worried about. And the other is the very simple question of whether or not a precise sum, which is realized at the corporate level, can be taxed at the individual level, even when it cannot be distributed. It's long been held that if you're a corporation or a partnership, there are ways to pass through the gain at the corporate level to the individual level. And these are perfectly uncontroversial. In most of those cases, there's always been an easy option to keep or to get the money out. In the Morse case, you can't do this at all. They're just trapped there. To tax them on the fair market value of their stock is to overtax them. And it may well be that they have to pay the tax now and they'll never be able to get the money back. So the simple argument to make is if you can't distribute this, the correct thing for the government to do is to defer the tax until the cash is distributed. And at that point, the estimation problem disappears because the value of the cash in the corporation is worth less to you than the cash itself would be worth if you can get your hands on it. And just defer this thing a bit and the whole problem goes away. And so when the case gets argued by the government side, nobody wants to talk about the nightmare scenario associated with taxing unrealized appreciation in stock and every other asset that we know. Everybody fights on the narrow question as to whether or not, when you look at this, you could tax the corporation, the individual, for a precise amount of money that's in the corporation. This is not a very big deal. I think it's important to try to get everything right. But if you're talking about what was expected, if you had people writing, look at Hague Simons, that's the definition that we really want to apply on this thing, I would be shuddering in my boots. But what happened is virtually every one of the other briefs concentrates on the fact, well, in 1864, if you had realized gain at the corporate level, you could tax the shareholder level in the Civil War taxes that we had. Well, this means that there's been a massive retreat from the major contentions. And so at this point, you have a technical discussion. It's really a very interesting discussion as to which way it ought to go. And my attitude about this is I think the petitioners are right in this case on the narrow grounds that I gave. But if they lose on the narrow grounds, it's not going to have much of an effect on anything, because the case which seemed to have the possibility of transforming the entire tax system has now become a gentle little cat instead of a roaring lion. And I think the answer that we have is we now watch this thing. We make all sorts of technical arguments and so forth. We could worry about the history of the 16th Amendment. But if all you're worried about is whether or not trapped cash in a corporation is taxable to a shareholder to whom it cannot be distributed, this is a very small issue in a very, very large city. And as I went through all this stuff, what I did in my brief was to explain with John Yoo how it is that the formula that they want to put into place is absolutely ruinous by taking the Hague-Simons formula and applying it to case after case after case where it simply doesn't work. And this is really in some sense unfair, because I'm a champion of the Hague-Simons formula. This is the formula which says that tax is on accession of wealth plus consumption. The reason why I like the formula is if you look at certain kinds of tax transactions, beginning to end, from the time you invest to the time you cash out. In many cases, there are all sorts of subsidies built into the system. So if your total gain is X, it turns out that the tax on that is going to be one half X, or some fraction of the total amount that you get. And what the Hague-Simons formula allowed you to do, if you actually looked at transactions that were completely realized, was to realize that there were implicit tax subsidies built into the system and that you should try to do something to eliminate them. And so when I wrote about this as far back as 1971, what I said is this is a very useful tool to figure out when the government is making unfair concessions to various taxpayers. It had nothing to do with collectability or anything else. And that was the way in which the formula was used originally. That's the way it should be used. The thought that it's a formula for taxation as a point, as opposed to a formula to evaluate completed transactions, that's what's completely crazy about the way in which it goes.
And Professor, as an amateur reader of your columns, it occurs to me that your narrow interpretation is not the one that is politically attractive at this point to the majority of the Democratic Party in the U.S. Senate. They mean to tax unrealized gains. And I go to you in your essay, you cite 1920, Eisner versus McComber.
Yes.
Where the Justice Pitney ruled that common stock-on-stock dividend cannot be taxed. It's not taxable. That is commonplace in the markets today. You take a dividend in more stock. It's made very easy by whoever holds on to you. You know, the big banks hold your stocks.
That would mean no problem at all.
That would mean that they would be taxing every time you gain more stock. Whether the stock was going, and what are they going to do on years when the stock goes down?
You have that problem. The ironic thing about the Hague-Simons formula is that with a recapitalization of a company like that, there's no gain. You get new stock worth $100, and the stock that you already have is worth $100 less than it was before. And so what happens is the Internal Revenue Code is very well organized. It has a huge number of what we call non-recognition transactions. That is where you actually have a gain because you receive property, but we don't tax it because there are liquidity constraints and valuation constraints, which makes it totally foolish. Then there are other kinds of assets, which are pure financial assets, not productive assets, derivatives, stock options of one kind or another.
Right.
And the rule is for those, you always tax them at the end of the year, whether or not realization takes place, because there's too much room for gameplay. And there's no liquidity problem. You can sell those things in 2 seconds. There's no valuation problem because it turns out you know to the fraction of a penny how much they're worth. And so what you do is you switch regimes as a function of the kind of assets that
are the advocates of taxing unrealized gains making the distinction that you just made? Because my reading of the politics of this is that they want especially to tax the rich who sit on unrealized gains. And so therefore they're going after everything, correct?
Yes. What happens is the politicians are not taking the position that the tax professors have taken. The best of those briefs was by my tax colleagues at NYU. And they said, read it narrowly. And they came out with the conclusion that you could tax at the individual level the $15,000 that play at the corporation. But what Bernie Sanders wants to do and Elizabeth Warren wants to do is they want to open up the nightmare that I mentioned and basically tax unrealized appreciation of every asset. Yeah, they're insane.
Insanity has the majority in the U.S. Senate, and it's likely to have the majority in the Congress soon enough. Now, Richard, a detail.
They don't have that.
There's six members of the Supreme Court who are presented as conservative. Does that mean that more will be decided narrowly or broadly?
Well, I think there are 9 justices of the Supreme Court who will decide it narrowly. I don't think there's any sentiment to do it broadly because after the government raised this issue, in opposition to the petition on certiorari, it just simply abandoned it when it wrote its final brief. It wrote a very nice kind of professional brief on one side of the case as opposed to the other side of the case. I may have disagreed with them, but my blood pressure remained constant throughout the entire enterprise. Not a single one of the briefs that I read on the other side got me a little bit upset, except the two by Akhil Amar and Bruce Ackerman, who wanted to go back and to basically make sure that everybody understood that everything that happened in 1895 was the devil's own work and that the 16th Amendment is a great achievement for progressive politics. It was in a fashion. But as John and I wrote, and this is mainly John's work, at the time of Pollock v. Farmer's Loan, what happened was very simple. There was a tax. The question is whether or not you could impose tax on rentals from leased property. And what happened was the government said, no, it's like a tax on the property itself. And the dissent said, yes. And there was a big battle over that. And it got completely confused because the lease probably contained both rents for services on the one hand and for the use of the land on the other, which should get very different treatment. What happened is the 16th Amendment comes along. And as John reminded me, nobody cared about the realization requirement. What they cared about was the direct tax requirement, and they wanted to take the position of the dissent that you could tax the rent. If you could tax that rent, you're not taxing unrealized appreciation. You're taxing an exact sum of money. And so even if you take the reformist position and overturn Pollock against Farmer's Loan, it doesn't say a word about the thing that the current left wants to do, unrealized appreciation.
And you believe the court will keep it narrow. We have another issue we must attend to. The word insurrection. Okay. Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.